Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. My guest today is Dr. Louise Aronson, a renowned geriatrician, educator, and the best-selling author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Her work challenges outdated views on aging and calls for a more compassionate, inclusive approach to elder care. Dr. Aronson, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start off by asking, what led you to focus your career on older adults? Did you always know that you wanted to work with this population?
No, absolutely not. Never crossed my mind, as I think it doesn't for so many people. Although we're seeing more people thinking about it as there are more of us with gray hair.
Indeed.
I thought I would do pediatrics, honestly. And then it turned out that the nurses were nice to the children and the doctors had to do horrible things to them. And I did not have the fortitude for that. Although I'm not sure that's how a pediatrician would explain what she really sure. does. But that was my rotation experience as a medical student. I couldn't be a surgeon of any kind because I don't see well enough. So then I ended up, my last rotation was internal medicine. And by chance, I was at a place with older people. And then it still didn't really occur to me, but in residency, I realized that I really enjoyed taking care of older people for a series of reasons. One was you couldn't really take care of the part without thinking about the whole. And I'm a person who's more interested in people than livers or diseases. You got to involve the whole family. It was intellectually more challenging. And because so few people were doing it, it felt like you were doing something needed and important.
Interesting. That's great. Now, you wrote Elderhood, as I'd mentioned at the start of our conversation, which is a book about what it means to grow older in today's world. It blends personal stories, medical insight, and cultural critique. What inspired you to write Elderhood?
Oh, well, I think, you know, everything about my life, probably. I wrote it in my 50s. And so I had a good couple plus decades of career of seeing all the things that happen to older people, you know, for better and worse, of thinking about aging. I had aging parents. I had reached the stage of life where it occurred to me that this was going to happen to me as well. I think we're somewhat delusional for a while before that. And I didn't really see anything out there. There's actually a great and growing literature on aging, but I didn't see anything out there that quite had the empathy or the breadth I was going for. And then I came up with this notion of elderhood as a sort of equivalence to childhood and adulthood. And I thought that was a reframe that might be helpful for us both as individuals and as a society.
I love that. Now, you do talk about it as a distinct life stage, as you just mentioned. How is it different from how society traditionally sees aging?
Well, you sort of see this everywhere, where in some ways people will say, I'm not old, even if they're in their certainly 60s, but 70s, 80s, if they are still functioning. But I think if we're really honest with ourselves, you know, we tend to equate old age with frailty or dependence, and we don't like frailty or dependence, so it gives old a bad rap. But what we actually see biologically is that the organism has the hallmarks of old age by one's 60s in most cases. Now, this can go really differently if you're a person who's been living on the streets or a person who's highly privileged, eats largely vegetables and exercises regularly, right? So when you look old might vary by a matter of decades. But the truth is, when we think about childhood, we don't mean a neonate or a toddler or an adolescent. We mean those hugely different, and I mean different biologically, socially, functionally, between a newborn and a young adult. And even for adulthood, you know, a 20-year-old is not a 60-year-old. There can be two generations between them. And yet somehow for old age, we don't acknowledge the similar diversity between the ages of, let's take legal old age at 65 and my oldest patient at 111. 105 is probably more common, but we should still acknowledge that that's 40 years. It's a couple generations. And to lump it all into a single horrible something is inaccurate and also really not helpful when we're trying to create a society for all of us.
I think that's really a great point, because I'm always amazed when I'm taking surveys, and you know, we conduct surveys ourselves from time to time, when the top end is always 65 plus. You know, below that, it's typically, you know, by 10 years, 45 to 50, right, or 44 to 55, et cetera.
It's insulting. And when you see this in scientific studies, it absolutely lacks rigor, any evidence of truthfulness, and yet people do it all the time. The other thing, which I just saw on I guess it was an email, but it's this incredible epidemiologist who's been doing great work since the pandemic, but she was reporting flu deaths for this year, which were up. And I'm going to get the numbers not quite right, but there were something like 118 deaths of children. Now, you know, I don't know anybody, and I'm glad I don't know anybody who's in favor of the death of a child. That is horrible. But there were 25,000 adult deaths, and yet the graphic and the lead were both about the kids. And it kind of just writes the rest of life off. And I think when you write the rest of life off in one sector, you lend yourself towards the tendency of doing it elsewhere. So it's just, it's inaccurate. It's not helpful. And it's disappointing.
Well said. Now, what are some of the most damaging cultural narratives about aging that you wish you could rewrite?
Well, I think one of them is what we've just talked about, that old people don't count, or that we're all the same after age 65, even though I have yet to meet a human being that didn't know people 65, 85, 100, and, you know, that could tell the difference. I mean, I think a child could tell the difference. So there's some sort of primal fear that we're not dealing with. We have gotten better about death. I wouldn't say we're good about death, but if you look within medicine, I sort of like to use medicine as a paradigm for what's going on in the larger society, because I think they are really happening in tandem. Geriatrics has been around for decades. It remains small. Palliative care came in the late 90s. So sort of there's hospice, which is when you're dying, and palliative care is a comfort care approach that can happen at any point in life, including when you're dying. But palliative care is sort of popular and sexy. And I think there are a host of reasons for that. But I also think once culture gets more comfortable with something, it can deal with it better. It's also tends to be, death is sort of a one-time event, whereas old age can go on for years, and that scares people too. I think when we equate old age with frailty, and when we say being frail is inherently bad, we harm anyone who's frail at any age. We harm our future selves. Because we create, it's sort of a self-perpetuating fear. And the people I know who live best in old age and die best in old age are ones who recognize their changes, adapt to those changes, and learn how to thrive within them. Which, if you think about it, like adolescence, do you really want to go back there? The stressful time when you've got young kids and a career, you know, there are all kinds of difficult phases that we manage our way through. And I think we can do that for this as well.
Sure. And I think you've been describing this to a degree, at least, but what to you does a more empowering and inclusive vision of elderhood look like?
It looks like an acknowledgement that it's a many decades long, highly varied phase of life, and it varies across its decades, but also among individuals. I just think it's a more generous and more accurate view of it that parallels what we do with children and adults. And I also think we need to empower people to embrace the difference instead of apologizing for the difference. It's the only stage of life where people apologize all the time for existing, for not being able to do things. You know, sometimes earlier on people will, but there are many movements to say, like, I have a right to exist. I have a right to be the way I am. And somehow old age is such a negative thing that it's hard to get movements going that really catch on, because no one wants to be a part of that group. There are exceptions, Grey Panthers, et cetera, but they haven't caught on the way other sort of civil rights or human rights measures have.
That's a really interesting point. Now, are there societies or cultures out there where you think they're doing a better job of embracing aging?
Ah, this is such a tough question. In some ways, the modern era, I think starting with the Industrial Revolution, but certainly made far worse by the Digital Revolution, valued speed and a certain flavor of efficiency over the quality of the work or the relationships involved in the work. The expertise brought to the work, and that has devalued older people across societies. You know, people often speak of Asian cultures where there is more respect, but if you actually look at what's happening in a variety of countries in Asia, it's getting worse, not better. You know, there are places like Japan where they have systems for, you know, everybody's trained the way we get some training in CPR. They're trained to recognize somebody who has dementia and maybe a bit lost or confused. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, they have many deaths from loneliness and isolation. So there aren't societies that are doing this perfectly. Ones that do it better tend to be the small, fairly homogenous Northern European countries that sort of are more inclusive and have parallel systems for older adults, as for children and adults, for living, for social life, et cetera. But I feel like we're in the century of opportunity for this. If the human population is shifting towards older, well, not if, it is, right? As it continues in that direction, I think this is a real opportunity for innovation, creativity, and improvement in how we live. You know, money needs to be mentioned here too, because in societies where elders are sort of cast out or abandoned, that's often because they can't afford them and people are choosing between their children and their elders. So a social support network is important. Not pitting one group against another. You know, that's all of human history. It gets better and worse throughout time. Right. But in an ideal world, it's not a fixed pie. So I don't know of a society or culture that does it perfectly. And I think this is a moment for us to get really creative. And some of the most creative people in this space are the people moving towards it or living in it. And then there are an increasing number of sort of, I might say, opportunists. And opportunists can be good or bad. Some people are in it to cash in, and some people are in it to make life better. So I think we'll continue to see innovations in this area.
That's great. You know, and I think that's well said about the two different sides of the opportunist coin. I'm not going to ask you to name, ones that are trying to just simply cash in. But what might an example of an opportunist be that is doing it well and that is really adding to the you know, I guess the whole cache of knowledge and innovation for aging adults, older adults.
Well, I am contacted not infrequently lately by people at business schools who are focusing on, you know, what's called now the elder space. I don't know. It's been called that for over a decade, and somehow this just ages me that I find that a weird use of the word space still. But anyway, in the elder space, and they seem really good-hearted, often motivated by the love of a grandparent. And so they're trying to bring a business acumen, a way of making something sustainable, because so many of the sort of services and programs have relied on funding sources that are soft and unreliable, frankly. And so I see these young people in their 20s, you know, who are reading about aging and really trying to compassionately think about how to make something that is economically viable and socially sustainable. So I think those are good opportunists.
That's a great point. And a few episodes ago, we had Lindsay Beagley from the Age Friendly University Global Network and Mirabella at ASU. And it's amazing seeing some of the work that is being done out there with intergenerational programming, really making it a seamless experience for older adults and for university students to interact and just have it be a normal part of life to have older and younger working and learning together.
Right. We actually just started something with Harvard Medical School called Age Pairs, where we pair alums who are over age 65. I think our oldest is in the later 90s and the youngest is in the later 60s, but with first year students, and it's bi-directional. So the student gets mentoring, maybe they have a similar interest in a particular specialty, and learns about aging. And for the most part, the pairs have loved it and have created these lovely ongoing relationships. And you know, so often in medical training, at least, when you see old people, it fulfills the societal prejudice because they're sick and looking small and frail in a bed. And this shows them like, no, actually, they're out there running a company or
that's wonderful.
Running a marathon or not doing those things, but sitting there with their brain perfectly able to teach you all kinds of important things.
That's great. Now, you mentioned, I believe, that you have one patient who's 111, kind of the
I did. She is no longer with us, as happens to 111-year-olds more frequently.
That's right. That's right. And I'm sure she had a wonderful life. But what do you – and I know there's no secret, there's no silver mm-hmm. bullet, but and there's also quality of life as we age, not just simply living longer. But, you know, what are you seeing in those folks who do live longer? What can we draw from that? What can we learn from their experience and apply to our own?
Yeah, there are actually some great studies that have followed, you know, either nuns over time or centenarians or super agers. And among the things that are sort of commonalities. You know, early education helps, but probably more important are strong social relationships, not getting stressed out, which just goes to show I'm not going to be a centenarian. But anyway, I know what to do. I don't do it very well. But
that's
yeah, really like
case.
Handling stress. Something goes wrong. You just, you know, it happened. I'm moving on. Traits we all should have, but not all of us are lucky enough to get it. A sense of humor helps. So really basic things, because it's very interesting. You'll see the people who've smoked and clearly hit a genetic jackpot and into their hundreds, and the people who've done everything perfectly. But it really is these socio-behavioral traits and a little genetic good fortune that lead people to be very old and successfully so. Because some people are very old and wish they were no longer with us.
Sadly, yes, you're absolutely right. I've talked to many of those folks as well. But, you know, and of course we've studied, as I'm sure you have, the you know, Dan Buettner's Blue Zones and some of the other you know, topics. But it is interesting to see where you can draw some commonalities and some threads. But I'm curious, Dr. Ernson, what are you looking forward to as you age?
Oh, well, a dramatic decrease in the aforementioned stress. really just not feeling like I'm constantly behind and owing things to patients, students, friends, this feeling like I have no reserve. You know, having time to like get up and maybe I read the news or I read a book and then I exercise and then maybe it's like 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning and I don't have to be freaking out that I'm hours late for work. And just that freedom of having time to do the things that I so often feel like even when I have time, I don't quite have the wherewithal. And what I notice among my older retired friends is that they have the time and energy for their passions and there's a peacefulness to it. Now, these are generally people without huge health problems, but I've also noticed that health things interrupt periodically and then life goes on. So I'm really looking forward to that.
That's great. No, that's a beautiful thought. So shifting to the healthcare system, obviously you've worked within that throughout your career. What are the biggest ways that our healthcare system fails older adults today?
They're an afterthought. They're not an equal citizen in the structures and policies of medicine. Everything from a health professional training to hospitals and specialists. So, you know, even a small child could tell the difference between an 8-year-old, a 48-year-old, and an 88-year-old. And yet we have children's doctors and adult doctors in huge numbers, children's cardiologists, adult cardiologists, children's hospitals, adult hospitals. And what do we have for older adults? A small handful of clinicians. We have training programs across the board, so physical therapy, social work, medicine, nursing, pharmacy, et cetera, where you get a few hours training on older adults, the group most likely to require medical care, physical therapy, occupational therapy, you know, drugs, et cetera, and months on children and years on adults. So there is just a baked-in bias that the people who need the services most are least important. And some of that comes from the cure mentality that happened in the 20th century, and some of it comes from sort of the ambient prejudice in society, I believe. But literally the economic structures and the institutional structures are baked in fundamental age bias.
Talk about the cure mentality.
Yeah, so there is this notion that, you know, fixing something is sexy, but helping someone live with or through something is less satisfying. And I think it's a particular sort of frame. You know, there's maybe a hero mentality. There's maybe, you know, certain sorts of people are fix-it people and other sorts of people are more sort of relational people. It is a somewhat gendered historical truth, I think less so in this century. So then it's like, is it gendered or was it socially structured gender? But that's like a whole heavy conversation that we can skip.
Sure.
My mother was recently in the hospital and it was all these female surgeons who were awesome. In my era, it was all male surgeons. So, yeah. So, you know, and that's a fix-it specialty. So that's why I say it may not be who we are based that, on. Anyway.
That makes good sense.
Yeah. But I think, you know, there is a gratifyingness to fix-it. But I would argue there's a huge gratifyingness to making things better and to going through something with someone and alongside someone and getting to know them over time. Somewhat because of the digital era, we have these snapshot sort of specialties now that are very popular. Anesthesia, I put you to sleep. For your surgery, I'm out of there. ER medicine, I take care of you. I send you home or I send you upstairs. You know, even palliative care, you're dying, I take care of you, you're gone. Hospitalists, I take care of you when you're in a hospital, you're gone. So there is this sort of brief interaction, we fix you as best we can and we send you off notion, built on the inherent satisfaction of fixing someone entirely, which I don't want to pretend that isn't hugely gratifying because it is. You know, like you think you're dying and I fix you and you're thrilled. I'm thrilled too.
That makes perfect sense.
But walking through life with people, helping them feel as their best, function as well as they can, I find hugely satisfying and meaningful. You know, but that's probably why I'm a geriatrician. So.
That's very true. So, you know, mentioning geriatrics, why is it still such an underrepresented and undervalued specialty in medicine, especially given the rapid growth in the aging population?
Yeah, I think there are many reasons. You know, some of it is the old age bias. Some of it is that cure, not care sort of mentality. Some of it is the structures of the health system. We often find people come into medical school wanting to do geriatrics, and it is literally trained right out of them. Why would you waste you're perfectly smart. You could do something else. I mean, these are literal quotes. Why would you want to spend your career on people like that? You know, it's just incredible. But I also believe that geriatrics itself has been its own worst enemy, because what it has done is the opposite of what, you know, people, fundraisers and politicians and other people know, which is to say, there are too few of us, so we're going to focus on the oldest and frailest. Then they become associated only with the oldest and frailest. I mean, people all the time will say, I don't need a geriatrician. I'm still doing quite well. The notion of geriatrics was supposed to be, we help you age well. And when you are very old and frail, we also take good care of you. But it has associated itself with this narrow and to most people, the most terrifying aspect of life. And then it wonders why nobody wants to join the party. It's also a failure of its mission, in addition to like a bad marketing policy. Because when the word was coined, it was coined to be an analog to pediatrics. And as we've said before, that's whether you're a sick neonate or a thriving teenager. So it's what we should be doing. It's also at this moment in history, there is stuff about healthy aging, like hourly, at minute to minute on my feeds. And yet we're not stepping up to give people what they want most. Like, why can't we help you age well? Because we understand older bodies better than other people. We have years of extra training. And then when something goes wrong, because it's a when, we all die, we'll also be there with expert training. I just think that's a failure of the profession.
I think that makes perfect sense. Now, I'm curious, if you have an opinion on this, why do you think there is a bias against older adults in our society? Is it that we don't want to face our own mortality? Is it that older adults, generally speaking, aren't contributing the same to our economic system as middle-aged working adults, if you will, or is it something else?
I think it's all those things. One of the problems is that we live in a world where they like, you know, people want things to be clear cut. Here's the villain and here's the whatever. And I think it's multifactorial. You know, there is a sense of, oh, they're going to be a burden. They're not contributing. Although that comes hand in hand with age prejudice that is documented across all sectors, where people who want to work either cannot get jobs or are pushed from their jobs. So we have to acknowledge that the society creates the problem and then whines about it. I think people fear being more frail. When you're young, you're looking at that sort of peak of human power, and it's exciting to head towards it. It seems to be a natural human reaction to not want to lose that. Even as other things get much better, I think we also don't talk about the ways in which life is much better, because when we do happiness surveys, life satisfaction surveys, stress surveys, older adults are in way better shape than adults. So there's an economic component, but I think that's brought in to justify a bias, a fear, an othering, you know. And I say that not as a person like, oh, you shouldn't be othering older people. I othered older people. I othered them both in the sense of having no clue that I would become one. I mean, it's insane, right? And thinking like, oh, you know, I'm helpful. Which is so condescending, right? And I see my young colleagues do it with the best of intentions, you know, with really good hearts. But I think it's easier for us to think about adulthood and childhood because we've lived through them. And it is other by definition. And that's another reason why older people need to claim their old age, stand up, talk about what it's like, call out the injustice. And yet we live in a society, as you can read about in the book, I used to dye my hair and then stopped because I didn't want to be a hypocrite. But it does make it hard. You will look older than other women, particularly. And when I say to people of all ages, I'm old, because I also want to own that, although I'm not 65 yet, but, you know, technically I feel like if we start owning it when we look the part, they will usually say, oh, no, you're not. As if I've just insulted myself, which is the whole freaking point, right? Like, it's not an insult. It's a statement of fact, and there's nothing wrong with it.
And in some ways, it can be a badge of honor.
Exactly. I earn these with my stress.
You know, it's interesting watching some of the personalities in pop culture, and I think they are also changing, you know, our view of aging. Paul McCartney was just on the, you know, last few weeks on the SNL 50 music or the event, and you know, with Mick Jagger, and then you have you know, other older adults, of course, Betty White, who's since passed, but you know, who was popular into her, you know, 99, almost made it to 100. But you know, so I think some of that is really shifting how we think about older adults. Hopefully,
yeah,
it's translating into the broader society, not just you know, some of those pop culture icons.
Yeah, although it's interesting with older women that are in pop culture, they're advocating for aging in ways that I find, you know, sort of cognitively, intellectually very powerful, good arguments. But at the same time, they have gone to huge expense and trouble to look years younger, which is just saying, like, I'm buying into that beautiful is young.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, I mean, I don't know, I've never been beautiful. Maybe if I did, I'd want to hold on no, to it more. I have had a few patients where I wondered about that. It, you know, and it, for their jobs, it's a part of their job in the way it's not a part of my job or life. So,
sure.
So on the one hand, I have empathy for that. On the other hand, it does seem a little bit of a contradiction. Like you're making the problem worse as you're making the problem better. But they also have to survive in the society we live in. So I think we have to have empathy for that. Even though for some of them, they were so beautiful, I feel like they would look better if they would not have done that to their faces. But anyway, that's just me.
I definitely agree. So I guess getting back to the healthcare system specifically, what are some examples that you see regularly when it comes to ageism in medical practice, and what can be done to address it?
Oh, you know, there's little things and big things. There's people talking using elder speak, which is when you talk to an older person the way you might talk to a pet or a young child. So your voice gets, and you say, oh, dear, let me help you with that. Oh, sweetheart, you know, which is just like shocking and insulting and condescending. And usually people mean well, and they don't even know it's a thing or that they're doing it half the time. But that's insulting. It's bigger things like they don't adjust the dose. So we actually have some better measures of kidney function now that are more accurate and give you a better sense. But not realizing, like, this person's – so how medicines circulate in the body depends a little bit on your fat-muscle ratio, which changes a lot with age unless you're at the gym constantly lifting weights. You know, the way your kidneys and liver work to metabolize change, and they don't adjust the dose. And then when the person doesn't do well, they say they failed the treatment or they couldn't tolerate the treatment. They blame old age for what was a failure to incorporate aging pharmacology and physiology into their treatment plan. Then perhaps the most frequent one is either saying, like, we're not going to give you this because you're 84, even if you're 84 and you're making your own yogurt and biking 15, you know, miles a day and taking care of your grandkids and whatever else you're doing. And then on the flip side, it's like, oh, well, this is how we treat this kind of cancer, even though you're 84 on oxygen and can't do much because the treatment's going to kill you. So that's called under-treatment in the case of the healthy 84-year-old and over-treatment in the case of the frail 84-year-old.
Interesting. It goes back to the earlier part of our conversation. I mean, not exactly the same, but where you're lumping that entire 65 plus, let's say, you know, into the same category. You know, and it's interesting as you talk about altering your voice as you're speaking to an older adult. I've witnessed this and certainly heard about it, where if an older adult is there with, you know, an adult child, you know, often the eldest daughter, when you're addressing the needs of the older adult to the adult child, you know, that's completely insulting as well, right? Because it almost makes them feel, you know, infantile, or I'm not sure if that's the right word, but just not respected.
Right. And And often the person can give an answer, and maybe they would answer a little more slowly. You know, like you need to assess, is this a person who needs help or doesn't need help? And when it's happened to me with my parents, I just look at the parent, but that's because I'm trained, you know, and I'll say, Mom, what do you think?
Sure. No, that's a great point. So there's no shortage of areas where our healthcare system falls short in meeting the needs of older adults, whether it's access, affordability, or age-appropriate care, as we were just talking about. If you could change one policy to dramatically improve healthcare for older Americans, what would it be?
Policies are tough ones. Can I have two?
You may have two.
I guess one would be that training for all health professionals would be proportional to the amount of time spent on each population would be proportional to the amount of time they will be spending caring for that population. So the education system would look like the care delivery system, and they would get a lot more training in older bodies and lives and priorities. At a bigger level, I think what I would want for older adults is exactly what I would want for all of us, which is that we have a medical care system, not a health care system. The system literally profits the sicker you are, the more sick you are. So that is, there is no incentive for prevention, for keeping you healthy, for having long enough appointments to sort of not even triangulate. It's a much bigger, you know, thing than that, but to actually listen to all your problems and see how they fit together into you as a unique individual. So we would actually prioritize health and keeping you from becoming ill rather than profiteering off increasing amounts of illness, by which I mean like the hospital does best if you're in intensive care, better if you're in the hospital, horrible if you're in clinic, so they don't even care about that. But where would you rather be? I'd rather be in clinic than in the hospital or intensive care. So our system doesn't give us what we want and needs to be totally restructured to prioritize health.
That's a great point. And I mean, I don't work directly in healthcare, certainly, but I'd be curious to get your opinion. You know, it was maybe a decade or more ago where the reimbursement was changed to really incentivize low rehospitalization or having to go back into the hospital. Has that had any kind of an impact on focusing on the quality of care and keeping people out of the hospital and at home and rewarding the healthcare system for that? Or has it just not been effective?
I think it's helped a bit, but it might be tackling the problem the wrong way. Sometimes people bounce back because of complexity. And so it's not necessarily a failure of the initial hospitalization. It's a complex disease. It can also be a failure of the systems outside the hospital, which aren't understood well by people in the hospital. You know, we hear constantly from people in the emergency department in the hospital, well, this can happen as an outpatient. I'm like, right. So if we order an ambulance, the patient can't afford to go up the two steps and put them on a gurney and then drive them and then make an appointment and then have the son take off work. And then, you know, like they just don't get it. You know, or the things to reconcile, you know, you can't get an appointment with primary care now because primary care is so devalued. So the follow-up that would have made things, you know, avoided the complication didn't happen or happened in a 10-minute visit, a 10-minute post-hospital visit. There's no way. So the system sets up for failure. So I think it's an attempt to address a real problem that only addresses a slice of it, and therefore hasn't been as helpful as some people hoped.
Makes good sense. Thank you for that perspective. So talking now about, you know, the human experience of aging, you blended personal narrative, history, and clinical insight in your book, Elderhood. How do individual stories help us understand the realities of aging in ways that data alone can't?
There are actually these great studies by neuroscientists where they present similar information as just facts and information or as story. And what they find is when you are presented with something as story, more regions of your brain light up and you retain the information longer. And that's probably because you're pairing the cognitive with the emotional. And that leads to more like intercalated and complex systems being engaged when you learn the information. I also just think, you know, storytelling is something every culture has done throughout time. And it appeals to us in some way that must be the way our brains are built. It generates empathy. So it's easier for people to write off a whole class of people or even a family. But if they hear the story of one individual, you know, it's why politicians use this. It's why the Olympics will highlight a particular athlete. Our brains respond to that. Our emotions respond to that.
Sure. Well, that's a great point. Now, what stories from your patients have stayed with you?
Oh, well, there's a lot of them in the book, as you can tell.
Absolutely.
Usually the stories that stay with me are when I was surprised. Certainly if I did something wrong or I didn't do, I would do it differently in retrospect. I think, again, that's where emotion kicks in. If you feel guilt or shame, even if your intentions were good, you know, doctors are human and we will all do better sometimes in retrospect than going forward. Things I feel badly about definitely stick with me. Things where I had a real connection with the person, which is a ton of people. So maybe it's the combination of a connection over time and dramatic events, something really happy, really sad, really surprising. I mean, I think I write these books because the stories stick with me in large numbers. And this is a way of getting them out and sharing them.
I think that's great. Yeah, I loved each of the stories, and each one has such an important perspective. But what's one story that you wish every healthcare provider could hear?
Oh, well, it's a joke more than a story, and okay. It's in the book. I've trouble remembering the age. So apparently this really happened in New York. I thought it was sort of lore, but then a colleague told me that it had happened. So I can't remember how old. I think 94-year-old guy, maybe 88. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. So guy develops knee pain. And he wants to go see his doctor, but the doctor's not available. So goes to see someone else. The doctor takes a history. He moves the knee around, does a whole exam. And he says, well, you know, I can't see anything wrong with it. It's just old age, you know. And without missing a beat, the old man says, well, but my other knee is the same age and it doesn't hurt a bit. So the point there is when you write something up to old age, you're abdicating your responsibility. Old age increases your risk for things, but it is not in and of itself a diagnosis.
That's great. And I can see some witty older gentlemen saying that, but that,
I know,
that
totally.
Does make a great joke.
Don't you wish you met that guy?
Like, absolutely. That's fantastic. Yeah. I hope I have that kind of quick wit as I age. But how do older adults themselves talk about aging, and how is that different from the way society talks about it?
Well, I'm going to say part of the problem is that it isn't so different. That older people will talk about the bad stuff more than the good stuff. And I'm not saying the bad stuff isn't bad, or it isn't disappointing, or it isn't hard, or it isn't painful. All those things are true. And there's lots of good stuff. You know, like sometimes I'll be with older friends in their 80s and usually we just have normal conversations, but it could get on to, oh, well, this one has that cancer and this one is having a hip replacement and that one is, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you know, so it's the organ recital, as people say, or the disease recital. But I think what they don't see is the other part of the conversation where they're talking about all the movies they've seen, and that they tried this new restaurant and that they went on this new walk or that they saw these friends and like all these things I don't have time for, you know, and that sound pretty good to me and that they clearly enjoyed. So I think acknowledging the good with the bad is a way older adults can help. And I just wish we could all look at it a little differently and more positively, not to spin or to disregard, but to acknowledge the full complexity of each life stage, including this one.
That's a great point. I've heard, I've spoken with a lot of older adults who say that they're busier, you know, in retirement, whatever that word means to different people, but right. You know, than ever, because they can finally do the things that they want to do. And boy, are they taking advantage of it.
Exactly. And another way people disrespect older people is they'll say they're going to come at a certain time and they won't come, assuming the person has nothing to do and they're just sitting there watching TV.
Interesting.
Which even if that is their life, maybe you said you'd be there at 3 and there's something they really want to see at 4. And if you show up at 4, you're inconveniencing them. Like, everybody's time matters. And if you're going to be late, call and tell them. But yeah, it's this, and I hear about this from people all the time that, you know, they just didn't show up and didn't call or showed up way late as if I didn't matter.
Sure, sure. So what role does identity, gender, race, class, et cetera, play in how people experience elderhood? I realize that's a really broad question, but what are you seeing?
Oh, well, it makes a huge difference. So in terms of sort of social class and opportunity, we have places like right down here in Palo Alto where there's a like 20-year difference in longevity, or there's a place in, North Dakota, I believe. I really apologize to anyone in the Dakotas, but sometimes I have trouble remembering which one it is. But there's a 35.
I grew up in North Dakota.
Did you? Okay.
Yep. So oftentimes it's the other Dakota because people always assume. No, that's fine. That's fine. But people always think Mount Rushmore, and I always have to say that's the other Dakota.
Right. Okay. So I'm not the only one. It is.
Oh, heavens.
It's horrifying.
No.
It's really not right, but there I am. So
no offense taken whatsoever.
How about in the Dakotas, in one of the Dakotas, to be unnamed, there's a place where there's like a 30-something year difference in longevity between two adjacent communities. And some of that has to do with class and economic opportunity. I think one is a Native American reservation and the other is a largely white community with much more education. And so that's how we pull race in, because race and class are so confounded in this country and I guess on this planet in many places. That often when we're talking class, we're talking race. Not always, because poor white Americans, same situation, you look in Appalachia or wherever. Gender is kind of interesting because women outlive men, but they have many more years of disability. So the experience of aging is different and its burdens are different for males and females. Women are much more likely to be impoverished, partly because they get paid less for the same work or for their work throughout their lives, significantly less. They're more likely to have had years when they weren't paid during child raising or elder care. So they end up with a lot less money, and that leads to poverty, and poverty leads to suffering. So there are all sorts of things. There's also right now an increasing class divide about who's availing themselves of healthy aging opportunities and who lives in a food desert or a neighborhood where you can't get out and exercise. Because if you want to live and have a healthy elderhood, in addition to, you know, some good luck, the bus doesn't hit you, some genetic component that isn't the majority of it. It's really about, education and eating healthy foods and moving your body.
Sure, sure. I was talking to somebody recently who said that his doctor had said, the best thing you can do is stand up out of your chair without using your hands. And that's one of the most fundamental ways to keep your limberness and such.
Definitely.
So I've been
and if you can better still if you can get up off the ground. You know, depending on your age group,
sure.
I'm not advocating for very old people to maybe get off without using their hands, but if you practice getting up when you need to get up, you'll be able to get up.
I'll have to work on that one next. So what do you say to people who view aging primarily as decline? Because I'm sure you interact with folks all the time.
Yeah.
Be they patients or others, you know, in other parts of your practice and your world.
Yeah. Well, it's actually interesting because physiologically, it's a little hard to counter that. You know, some organs get too big, some organs get too small, they work less well. So there is a perspective from which biologically it is a decline. So I think we don't want to pretend it's something that it isn't. But that's also saying that your experience of aging is a strictly biological process, which it isn't. We are social beings. We are relational beings. And so your body will decline. Like, I'm already disappointed in mine, and I, you know, I'm quite fit.
it's the reality.
It changes, yeah. But so there are a couple things. One is you can make it much better by trying. We can build muscle at any age. It's actually an article that was in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1994 that was part of what made me a geriatrician, was that they took people in a nursing home outside Boston, and they had them exercise. And people built muscle and were able to then walk without their cane or move from a walker to a cane. So, and that was at an extreme. They were already in a nursing home. So imagine if people not in a nursing home made an effort. Now, are you going to run a whatever minute mile? I don't know. My cousin's kid keeps posting his times. And like, that's not happening. Right. But could I get faster for my age group? Sure. Absolutely. Can I get stronger? I have been. And that's a total pleasure. And even if it's not what it was, even if you're in decline, to watch your improvement, to feel it, it is incredible. So acknowledge, yeah, things are declining and you have control over the rate of decline. And there are all kinds of other things that are social and relational and creative that are not in decline. And, you know, enjoy them.
That's great. Thank you. So, I know we talked about this a little bit earlier, but, you know, we've talked here on Roundtable Talk with past guests about intergenerational relationships and how powerful they are. You referenced the program at Harvard, mm-hmm. connecting older adults with students.
Medical students.
Medical students. Thank you. What role can intergenerational relationships play in how we more broadly think about aging?
Well, I think we live in such an age-segregated society that it sort of humanizes the people on the other end, you know, because young people make jokes about old people and old people make jokes about young people. So there's a bit of a divide. And there's a way that making jokes speaks to truths. But imagine if you could joke with instead of about, you know, and you could learn from each other's perspectives. You know, oh, I do it this way, not because I don't want to learn how to do something new, but because I did it this way with my husband and I miss him, you know. It just adds a wealth of opportunity to learn and to see yourself in the future and to realize we all have different value and to not, I guess it lowers the othering, frankly, you know, that we spoke of before.
Yep. Great point. Now, how can society broadly better support older adults in living fully, not just longer?
I think it comes back to the notion of elderhood, to have mm-hmm. programs that acknowledge the differences and opportunities of elderhood. You know, we spend a lot of money on treating fractures in elders. If we put that money into giving people, well, physical therapy has gone so downhill because they don't have time for anybody and they can only treat one thing as if the human body wasn't connected. But anyway, so, but to an, like a trainer or, you know, if the system enabled people to be stronger, fitter, have better balance or whatever, the costs of the orthopedic injuries, the fractures and falls are so high, you could likely pay for people to get the sort of training. You know, so again, it comes to this rebalancing the system and acknowledging that we have different needs in old age. Another thing I like to talk about for this, which is actually improving in certain neighborhoods, but usually high income neighborhoods, is that if you go to the average park, right, you see the whole playground, all those cool things they have for kids, and then you'll see the basketball courts, the tennis courts, the baseball diamond, whatever. And what do you see for old people? Benches, right? No, and some older people can use all those same things. But now they're starting to have places where there are, well, it started with pickleball, but now it's sort of all bets are off with pickleball because A, everyone's playing it, and B, there have been a lot of injuries.
Indeed.
But really getting creative about there are these things that people can climb on to work on their balance safely. There are, and that sounds sort of infantilizing, like, does it look like the thing for kids? And maybe it does, but maybe if it's different and acknowledges the phase that people are in, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, this is like the one context in which being like aligned with kids seems kind of bad. And I guess I've mixed messages. You don't want to be spoken to like a child because you have an adult brain. But if some of these balance things that are helping kids get their coordination could help adults keep their coordination, that's it. I mean, speaking for myself, I think it'd be a good thing. I was never very coordinated and I could probably use some help around now. Sure. So yeah, just everywhere you look, you see kid, adult, elder, kid, adult, elder, everywhere.
Great points. I was just at a community not too far from where we are, which is in Lancaster County, the community is, and they have, I think it's called Life Trails, but these series of workout equipment pieces mm-hmm. around their community. And it is specifically designed for older adults. It's made by a playground equipment company,
right.
But they have designed the equipment so that it's safe and accessible and easy to use just as people are out on a walk.
See, that's awesome. And it's probably opportunism. The playground company has a limit fixed market and now they've over doubled their market, but they've also done something really helpful for all of us. This is just, that's a win-win.
Absolutely. So in your opinion, or in your vision, let's say, what would a truly age inclusive community or workplace look like?
You'd see people of all ages working, whether they were doing the same thing or a variety of things. You'd see people at the park, right? I mean, what you're describing, you would look around because you also hear commonly like, well, older people don't come to this restaurant. Or like, this happened in San Francisco around 2000 because with the first dot-com huge boom, restaurants made themselves intentionally noisier. And then older people, as we age, probably starting at the ripe old age of 50-something, people have more trouble with ambient noise. And so people weren't going to those restaurants. And they're like, why do we have to change our soundproofing? Because like they don't come here anyway. It gets very chicken and egg. And then after that, what happened was the younger people were finding they couldn't speak to each other either because it was so noisy. So I think you would, without having people apologize for having different needs, you would think about like, who would come to a restaurant like this? Oh, adults and elders. Okay, so what do we need to do for each group? Or who would come to this park? Well, people of all ages. Okay, so what do we do for each group? I feel like I'm just saying the same thing, but I think it's just
sense.
We see all of us everywhere and not anyone as a problem, an exception, a burden.
Sure. Now, I'm curious. Did I hear you say that the restaurants after the dot-com boom made their restaurants intentionally louder?
Oh, they did. Yes.
Why?
You can look it up because when it was louder, it sounded like it was a more happening kind
of place. More vibrant. Okay.
More hip. You'd want to be there. So like they lowered ceilings. They used materials where sound bounces off it. Like the opposite of what you would want.
Sure.
I think, if you were sane. Right. And then you think about these poor young people who are then, because they would have to scream to be heard. So they're all going to go deaf earlier than they would have.
Yep.
So that's not doing them any good. And it meant they weren't getting certain customers. But also, here's what older adults do. They say, oh, well, I'm not going to go there anymore. Instead of saying, like, this is age discrimination.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great point. And, it's interesting. I did a group. This was in Boulder, Colorado a handful of years ago, and took a group of older adults to a restaurant to have a conversation about, food and tastes and interests and that sort of thing. And as we were walking in, one gentleman was really looking around and wanting to specify where we sat. And, we were chatting about it. He said, because of his hearing aid, he always tries to sit against a wall.
In a corner or a
yep,
wall.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something I hadn't even thought about. But all of those things, those design elements, mm-hmm. can really make it much more friendly, I guess, to
right. And imagine if we all knew that, right?
Yeah.
if it was considered not a problem, but just a normal part. And so two couples come in, one's older, one's younger. You've got two tables. I'm going to put the older one in the corner because that's what I'm going to want for me when I'm that age.
Exactly.
Not so hard.
Yep. And you know, that notion of cross training and just elevating awareness is so important. So what gives you the most hope about the future of aging in America?
Ooh, I think it's the older people and the younger people both. I did a panel with, I think it was Rich Eisenberg who said this, but he said, well, you know, baby boomers have always been about ourselves. That's why in the 60s, it was, you know, free love or whatever else. I'm like the very tail of the boomer, so I didn't experience any of that, but he's older than I am. You know, and so now we're going to be about ourselves in old age, so we're not going to stand for this. And I do think we're seeing that the boomers are advocating for themselves and for services in a way we didn't see from great and silent generations who just sort of, you know, mustered on and quietly. So I think that's making a difference. And as people live longer and are functioning, you know, they're like, why am I not employed? I mean, there was a great statistic pre-pandemic. I haven't seen anything since, but that one of the biggest sectors of entrepreneurs were people in their 70s. And it was partly because they had some great ideas, and it was partly because nobody would hire them. So they were doing it for themselves. But I also think this generation of younger people have more awareness, probably because there are more older people and they're more visible. I would say early in my career, I would see almost nothing about aging in the media. And then it got to be monthly and then weekly and then daily and now hourly or, you know, probably yep, more so, yep. But who can attend to that?
Sure.
So I think it's more omnipresent and people are thinking about it more. And these intergenerational programs are really springing up. And hopefully they're being designed in such a way that it isn't like, oh, I'm volunteering with an elder, as opposed to, you know, it's mutually beneficial. I'm learning this and I'm teaching that.
Great point.
So I think it's more visible and people are responding across age groups.
Definite reasons for hope, which we need in this world. Last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
I would say that my younger self knew, but that she didn't listen. You know, it's all this stuff about, you know, I used to think I like to eat. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I was a runner, so I could eat a lot of cookies and it wouldn't do any harm, apparently, to my figure, I guess, is what I'm saying. But that doesn't mean it didn't do harm to my body, right? Sure. We know sugars are pro-inflammatory. So now I have like achy joints. If I'd eat fewer cookies, that might not be the case, you know? And it's so hard when you're young and you feel fine and you look fine to say to yourself, I'm going to not do this really fun thing, which helps me with my stress, you know, because it will pay off in the end. And I know there are people who do it and most of us don't. So I'm not sure knowledge is enough to change that, but I guess I would say, like, is there a way for you to be more moderate, in stress and in unhealthy behaviors? For me, that was mostly sugar.
Sure. But that's really insightful. Yep. And as you said earlier in our conversation, that low stress lifestyle is really what is one of the major keys, at least, to living a long, high quality life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So high stress and too much sugar. Oh well, I'm working on it now.
Hey, never too late, right? No time like the present.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Louise Aronson, thank you so much. Your book is Elderhood: Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. Wonderful book. Thank you. And really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. It was great talking to you.
Well, thank you again. And my name is Derek Dunham. Thank you to our producer, Dave Schaffner, and our engineer, Matt Campbell. And we'll see you next time on Roundtable Talk.